Welcome to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here. John off doing good work as usual. He's actually in volunteer hospice training, so good for him. He will be back tomorrow, but in the meantime...
You throw this ball through the hoop. A basketball.
That's right, Danny O'Neill, who we're coming to find out is being wasted in sports talk. He gets to spread his wings here on our show, and we're fortunate to have him.
Well, spread his wings might be an overstatement there. You're going to put me in water wings and let me try and tread water in the deep end of the pool.
Well, you filled in. You know, last Wednesday when John was gone and I was sick, you ran the show, and you did remarkably well. I was really impressed, Danny. You are a multi-talented guy.
Let's not get carried away.
I hope 710 there. ESPN appreciates you.
Let's not get carried away.
We're going to be taking advantage of your sports expertise later in the show when we look at an upcoming crisis of the NFL may be facing and do a little Super Bowl preview. But first, it's theme song after theme song after theme song. We have Hannah Scott with our top story today. It's about school safety, I guess, in Olympia. What's up?
So there's been a lot of discussion about school safety over in between legislative sessions. There was a mass shooting prevention task force that was put together. They looked at schools all across the state, a lot of experts, law enforcement, et cetera. And they came up with several ideas, recommendations that are now turning into bills that are going to start being heard today through next week. And they outlined several of those yesterday. Many who came out to talk about these and really endorse all of these was a woman who now lives in our state whose six-year-old daughter, Emily, was killed in the Sandy Hook shooting back in 2012. She's been through it. And she, you would think that someone like that and that some of these mass shooting prevention recommendations are about gun control, and they're really not. She, Alyssa Parker, the mother from Sandy Hook, outlined what she's found in working with a nonprofit that she created is working across the country.
All I saw were unfamiliar faces.
And what she ends up saying is that it's about preventing students, recognizing students who are maybe in crisis, who are suicidal, who are being bullied, things of that nature, teaching the school counselors and those who are there at the school how to interact with them, recognize that and report that. And it's not about enforcement or sending these kids to jail or having them arrested. It's about figuring out what kind of counseling they may need, where they need to go, getting the parents involved, things of that nature. It's also about making sure that should the unthinkable happen, the school is prepared and that the counselors and everyone there and the teachers and the principals are prepared. And that's where she's weighing in here.
I didn't see the school principal. I didn't see anyone. And unbeknownst to me, it was because the school principal was the first victim. And she, our leader, was not there. And without her, we had no plan. We didn't know how to supplement and step into those roles.
So she's talking about when she showed up at the school at Sandy Hook and there was just chaos. There was fire crews everywhere, parents, teachers. No one knew. No one was a leader. Nobody had a plan. And it cost precious time, valuable time for those first responders. So that's the idea with some of these recommendations. And there are 9 bills total, I think, just out of the House that deal with suicide prevention. And more importantly, this creation of a regional task force or regional safety centers in the 9 education service districts across the state, which is where they would have specially trained people who train and work with each of the schools to teach them about all of those things, recognizing students who might be in crisis and, again, how to respond when there is a crisis like that.
And does legislation seem like the way to go about this? Like, my wife is a school psychologist, so she spent all of her time. She deals with, problematic kids, I guess, would be the best way to do it. I mean, she would certainly be alert to things. What is it that legislation can do to increase the chances that these kinds of kids are don't fall through the cracks, I guess?
Well, first of all, the one piece of this legislation is to add more guidance counselors. I think it's an 80% increase in guidance counselors
really?
In schools.
Okay.
A lot of schools don't have guidance counselors, and that's one of the main parts of this, mental health and making sure that you identify and get conversations going with these kids that are in crisis is a big, big deal. Also, the suicide prevention aspect.
Where are the guns? Because there's no mention of putting more guns in the schools or of passing restrictions that will help keep the guns out of schools.
So there was some mention about guns and schools, and this came from Representative Dolan, who says it was specifically not mentioned in their package of bills.
You'll notice in the title, it says non-weapons. That was purposeful. Yeah. We believe that guns do not belong in schools.
But Senator Phil Fortunato disagrees. He disagreed last year. He put out a bill last session that would have armed teachers in schools under certain training conditions, and he's going to do that again this year.
I'm a little concerned that they purposely excluded firearms as something that was not even under consideration. The reason you want armed people on staff is to be able to respond in 1 minute to minimize that.
That's a very controversial proposal, something that the mass shooting task force, by the way, did discuss over the summer, and it was left out. It was decided that they don't want any more guns in schools, and so I don't know that that goes anywhere, but it's going to be discussed again.
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that the Democrats were the ones sponsoring the parent from Sandy Hook. The legislation being proposed that doesn't deal with guns are from the Democratic side of the ledger. Phil Fortunato is on the Republican side.
Yes.
The Republican side, for better or worse, are in the minority at this point. So my hunch is, as controversial as guns in schools policy would be, if the Republicans aren't in majority, they probably have a tough road to hoe to get that as part of legislation passed.
And possibly. And there's still, out of the mass shooting task force, again, there was not a lot at all as far as recommendations. And that was bipartisan. That was Senator Steve O'Bannon, Democratic Senator David Frock, both involved with that.
Okay.
The one really big significant piece that has to do with guns on that is having extreme risk protection orders apply to minors. And that's something from Senator Frock that will be discussed. It wasn't discussed a bit yesterday, but I think it's already had a couple of hearings.
What does that mean, the extreme risk?
So extreme risk protection order is something that we passed a few years ago, right? So it allows law enforcement or family members can petition the court to temporarily take away an adult's firearms rights, take their guns, if they are exhibiting certain kinds of dangerous behavior, talking about mass shootings or something of that nature. And it has to go through the court process, very strict. This would allow it to apply to 18 and under. Now, they're not legally allowed to have firearms. They don't have any firearms rights. But the idea here is to, you would then serve that ERPO, the Extreme Risk Protection Order, to that child's parent, thereby letting them know what they are legally obligated to do as far as safely storing whatever weapons they have in the house. And then if they were to violate that and the kid got a hold of the gun, they would then be subject to criminal offense.
Okay. And then the final question, I think personally, again, anyone who listens to the show won't be surprised by this. I think arming teachers is a spectacularly bad idea. However, I have no problem about resource officers being armed. Is that part of the Democratic plank of legislation being offered, that it's not that there are no weapons like they pronounce in the title, but there are some recognized people that are allowed to be armed and should be armed?
Yeah, absolutely. So
okay.
There's a couple of competing ideas going on here with school resource officers, but here's what I can tell you about school resource officers. They are all cops, period.
Okay.
They are not security guards. They are all law enforcement officers, and they all are armed. So they said yesterday in this that it would be up to the districts on whether they wanted their SROs to be armed, but they're all cops. So the one in my school is armed.
Okay.
So at any rate, there's also a bill from Senator O'Bannon coming up today that would ask for more school resource officers across the state. The Democrats' proposals did not include that.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Hannah. Denny, did you have anything you wanted to wrap up on the school safety business before
we
move
against
on?
A teacher having a gun if the teacher is interested in the extra certification and extra training to carry? Because I agree with you about I agree with you about not arming teachers and having them go through mandatory training. But the question about if a teacher is interested in doing that or wants to be certified, I don't see the problem with that. I trust teachers.
Yeah, the problem is that are you putting too much on a plate? You know, we had this. There may be a majority of states in this country that not only recommended, they actually they give you training and all of this. The problem is, I think that a lot of teachers think that they should be focused on something other than the life protection aspect of schools. And if a teacher is armed, could that teacher then, if the kids know that, if they know all their teachers are armed, could they get access to the guns? And how much training do they have? We did an in-depth study, an article on this in-depth study a few weeks ago. I was saying that they have nowhere near the kind of training that a police officer does. And even a police officer only, hits this target, you know, say 20% of the time, that if you have a lot of gunfire in schools, that the downside, the collateral damage, could be worse than the actual stopping. That's why I prefer this idea of having police officers in schools or armed resource officers who are really heavily trained. Now, I suppose if there was an exception, the article that we looked at, they took a kindergarten teacher. Can you imagine a kindergarten teacher? And she had no experience with the firearms, and she went through a six-week training of this. I mean, it's not 8 hours a day, but you know, after school kind of training, and she felt a little more comfortable around guns, but she still wasn't convinced that maybe she should have a gun in the midst of a classroom of kindergartners. And that's the issue. I mean, it's a hot topic, and there are a lot of people that tend to be on the pro gun side. You know, Todd Herman always throws at me, okay, what if there was an armed gunman, and you knew that I had a gun, wouldn't you want me to shoot him? And it's like, yeah, you create these scenarios, which may not be happening very often. In certain extreme circumstances, you may wish for that to be the case, but the collateral damage seems to me outweigh the benefits.
Yeah, I'm absolutely against the idea of if a teacher is not interested in that, or of unilateral,
yes.
Hey, we're going to train our teachers with firearms, because that's, I don't think that would make
sense. In fact, in this article, they had a teacher who was trained and was very comfortable, and I think he had a concealed weapons permit anyway, but independent of whether he was a teacher or not. And he says there are some teachers he'd rather not have guns.
Yeah.
So even though he was a
Senior Reardon, my Spanish teacher at Aptos High School, I would not have trusted with firearms.
Why?
Why? Because he was erratic. He would start screaming and yelling. That's the last guy I wanted to see armed.
Fair enough. So one thing we haven't really addressed, because it's not hitting us personally, is the unbelievable weather that's hitting the Midwest. I heard on the Seattle's Morning News they were like 50-degree, degrees below zero kind of weather. We want to talk a bit about this. Here's Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer warning constituents to stay inside if they can at all.
If you have to go out, layer up, get prepared, because just a few minutes of exposure could be very dangerous in this moment. And support one another, check on our elderly neighbors or vulnerable neighbors, and stay safe. I think it was prudent to tell every state employee, including lawmakers, don't go out on the road if you don't need to today. You jeopardize your own safety, but also you put first responders at risk if you slide off the road and require assistance. And I think that's something that's really important to be mindful of as well.
And so then the New York Times takes advantage of this U.S. Midwest freeze to talk about the weather extremes and whether they are indeed the example proof in the pudding of climate change or not. And they talk about right as it, you know, at the very same time that we're having these ultimate freezes in Chicago and in the Midwest, you've got higher than ever temperatures in Australia and wildfires out of control. There are a lot of extreme weather examples. And the question is this climate change at work?
Is it?
Well, according to this article,
no, it's not.
They say absolutely that it is, because what climate change is all about is about the extremes. Now, and one individual weather happenstance doesn't necessarily mean that that's an example of climate change. However, it increases the likelihood. And they talk about the fact that, so, you know, it used to be called global warming.
Mm-hmm.
Global warming was chucked in favor of climate change because they realize that sometimes the extremes may be not the global warming aspect. And they say, for instance, how do you explain, if it's global warming, how do you explain the freezing temperatures now that are extreme and, you know, outside the ordinary? And they say there is a climate change explanation, and that is if the polar ice caps are actually melting, that pushes the cold weather down farther south, and because of that, it actually can be attributed to that.
The other thing is, though, is that we're trying to evaluate weather patterns that take place over hundreds and thousands of years.
Yes.
And we're looking at it under a microscope of, oh, it's become more extreme over these past 10 years. And I remember this because we talked to, in a sports example, home runs spiked up in Seattle. The home runs, the number of home runs at Safeco Field spiked up.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, is that evidence of global warming? Because for years, what people have thought is that there are fewer home runs in Seattle.
Yeah.
Because of the marine layer.
Right.
And we've heard about it, that it's heavier air. It's down
true.
There by the water. And it's colder. So we're all of a sudden experiencing more home runs. I was like, well, this is a benefit of global warming. Like, it doesn't all stink. Like, maybe the polar ice caps are melting and it's going to create beachfront property in Nevada. But at least we're going to have more home runs here in Seattle. And so we brought on an atmospheric scientist on.
Yeah.
Yeah. We called over at the UW. We talked to him. And he was like, well, Are you looking at that it's tended to be a little bit warmer over the past few springs and diagnosing like widespread climatological change?
Yeah.
That's probably not as realistic. So anytime there's these sweeping, oh my gosh, things are becoming more extreme. We're having more hurricanes. There's more wildfires and all of these different things. Maybe it is. It's also really hard to draw conclusions off of what is a really narrow, narrow slice of
Danny,
time.
Looking at home run production in Seattle is a narrow focus. These weather looks are not that. Right now, they are projecting ahead like 2080. I mean, they are looking at century-long patterns. And they say that the extremes seem to be, you know, an indication of climate change. It fits a climate change model.
Yes.
Now, are you a climate change?
That part.
Okay.
It fits a climate change
model. So you're
not
a climate change denier.
No, I definitely think it's happening. Okay. I think we chalk anything that happens in the world up to climate change, though.
Fair enough.
And that everybody looks at it and like, oh my gosh, it's more cold now. No, you know what? Sometimes in Minnesota it gets cold, Tom. Like sometimes it gets really cold in Minnesota. Yes. And that shouldn't come as a shock to anyone. And the once in a generation cold that's there, if it stayed this cold for the next 6 months, then I would say, like, man, we've got something really weird that's happened that's really drastic and irreversible.
I think that's exactly right. And the thing is, for the longest time, for the last decade, I've been very chary about actually attributing one particular, you know, aspect of our weather, whether, you know, whichever extreme we're talking about, clock it up to climate change. However, they are saying now that the patterns of extremes that we're seeing are such that the five hottest temperatures have been in the last 10 years and all this kind of stuff, that there may be a pattern forming at this point. But, you know, what do the experts know when it comes to Danny O'Neill and Tom Tank?
No, idea that it fits, that this is possible and it's something to watch, I'm very hesitant to draw strong conclusions.
Yeah.
Plus, there's been some benefits, like El Nino happens more often, which, you know what that means? Big waves in California. It's a boon for the surfing economy, Tom.
Yeah, as long as the shoreline is still on the shore.
Well, as
and
long
not
as
in
it
the
stays there,
LA.
There's still a few years out on that. Looking to ensure football's place in the future, it's becoming increasingly tough. That's because it's harder to find insurance.
That's right.
We'll explain why that's important next on Tom and Curly.
This 9 a.m. hour of the Tom and Curly Show is brought to you by Laura's Home Loans. That's right, you're listening to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here, John Curly away, doing good work. He will be back tomorrow. It's just a one-day off situation.
Court-ordered good work?
No. This is volunteer hospice work.
As far as you know.
That's right. Would John lie to me? Maybe on the air, but not off the air. No, I think we're good. And John will be back tomorrow. But if you're wondering who the hell's voice that was Danny O'Neill from 710 ESPN. And this is a fascinating story. Actually, we've been sitting on this story for a couple of days because we thought you would be the perfect person to talk to about this. You know, 710 ESPN, you work at 710 ESPN, and ESPN as a network, as a huge organization, has been really been kicked in the teeth a lot by its politicized coverage. I mean, there's a lot of concern about what's happening at ESPN in terms of whether they're sort of, you know, flavoring the sports coverage.
They're liberal-leaning.
Yes, liberal-leaning.
I want meat and vegetables in sports, and they're
giving
me dessert. They're serving me up. I don't want politics with my sports, and gosh darn it, they're giving me politics.
But one of the things I've got to give ESPN credit for is they have this outstanding investigation show called Outside the Lines, and what we're going to talk about is an Outside the Lines investigation about the NFL and the evaporating insurance market, which could spell the doom of the NFL if they're not careful. This is ESPN investigative reporter Steve Fernaru, says football has an insurance problem, and he'll explain it.
The reality is that sports, like most risky endeavors, can't exist without insurance. And so you have a situation now where the insurance companies are looking at the proliferating litigation and they see a lot of risk there. They see a lot of potential exposure. And many of the companies are getting out of the marketplace. And that's created a lot of problems from the NFL all the way down to the youth leagues, particularly at the lower non-revenue producing sports. The NFL, of course, is with its resources, is well equipped to deal with this problem. But for Pop Warner, for junior colleges, it's a much bigger problem. And in some cases, we're seeing programs eliminated in part because of this issue.
And Ferneroo goes on to talk about just how serious this crisis could be.
Alex Fairley, who's the insurance broker for the NFL, put it plainly that if you are football or other contact sports, the insurance business basically doesn't want you right now. There's just too much skittishness in the market. Julian Bales, who's the medical director for Pop Warner and a member of the NFL's Head, Neck, and Spine Committee, called the insurance coverage issue arguably the biggest threat to the sport.
So, Mr. Sports Guy here, how seriously should we be looking at the demise of football, as at least as we now know it, because of the insurance market, which is an interesting new angle to take on the controversial sport of football, which most of us love dearly.
Certainly, it is a concern. And because when insurance companies are making decisions, it's weighing not even just the perceived, but the measured risk against what premium they should charge to cover it. Because I mean, the idea of insurance is very simple, is you get a bunch of people who buy coverage against a certain incident, a certain type of, whether it's a medical issue or damage to your home, like all of these different things, and that the chances are it won't happen to you. But if it does, you're covered. And the reason you're covered is because the insurance company is able to determine how much they need to charge to have an adequate pool of resources to pay out the claims.
Right.
It's a very straightforward. What has changed, and this probably traces largely back to the concussion lawsuit and settlement of NFL players, is there is a liability out there that insurance companies never foresaw, which is players years after they're done playing citing grievous medical conditions that require a payment to them, and that if they're going to be covered by insurance, if those are insurance companies might have these outstanding liabilities that they didn't really know about. And not only that, but those liabilities might continue going forward, especially if there's not a modification that you accept a waiver in which the participant accepts any future neurological injuries that may be sustained by suffering the sport, something that would essentially exempt them from insurance coverage. Now, the one thing that's interesting about the way that story is phrased is that they say contact sports.
Yes.
It's not just football. And this is the reason it should be. Soccer and hockey are included in here. And I think that most people would be surprised to hear soccer in this conversation. And I think it's fair and good to ask questions about the safety of football.
Mm-hmm.
And if insurance coverage isn't available, what that means for the future of the sport. But if we're talking about insurance being unavailable for the future of soccer,
any contact sport,
or hockey,
yeah,
like if it's going to start going there, you're going to have to start balancing risk. And people assume that not playing football reduces your risk.
Mm-hmm.
As a child, I want my kid to be safe, so they're not going to play football. Well, they better do something else other than sit on their butt and play video games, because you know what harms kids way more than concussions they suffer in football is obesity. Like, honestly, inactivity and those sort of things. And that, I think it's important to have a conversation, but it needs to be an honest conversation. Is soccer, behind football, the second highest sport in incidence of concussion is girls and women's soccer.
Yeah.
And some of it relates to the musculature of the neck. Certainly the question of headers. I was just talking to my sister. She has a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not kids should be wearing helmets when they play soccer because of heading the ball and those sort of things. And look, risk management is a very real concern for parents. But part of the risk management is the risk of them not doing physical activities and what that will mean.
Well, but they're all, I mean, for instance, baseball, I assume, I mean, you can get, you know, you get hit in the head by a pitch and you'd be in serious trouble, but that's not generally considered a contact sport, is it? Nor is basketball.
Basketball is not.
Yeah, so there are a lot of physical activities. In other words, I think you're right. You know, obese, the rare chance that you would suffer, you'd play football long enough that you'd end up getting a CTE versus, you know, sitting on your couch and, you know, dying of diabetes because your obesity level is out of control. That, I mean, I suppose that one outweighs the other. But there are a lot of activities. Track and field, those kinds of things. There are a lot of activities that aren't contact sports. And then the question is,
that stuff's not as fun. Who wants to just go run and jump? Honestly, like, why can't I hit somebody? I want to be able to do that. Heading a soccer
soccer ball's fun.
I think that's fine. And the idea is it shouldn't. What I want to, I guess, from your point of view, I understand why people like contact sports. The question is, if insurance companies won't pay for it, what is the way out? If insurance companies will not cover football, will the sport go away then?
I don't think the sport's going to entirely go away.
Okay, so then
yeah.
where does this shift? Can you actually force the individual team? So Seahawks exists, and it's up to the Seahawks to cover for any insurance. The Seahawks wouldn't do it, so then they put it on the individual players. Would they allow the individual players to say, okay, I'll take out insurance on myself? Nope, nobody would give you insurance. Then you'd say, okay, that's fine. If I'm corrupted for life by playing this game, it's on me.
It's easy to say with an adult, where you would say, if you're 18 yeah. or over, you can decide that for yourself. What if a high school kid says to you, yeah. I don't care what happens to me neurologically.
Yeah.
I want to play football.
Yeah, that.
Are we to the point where
state
we're going to start?
Or the parents have to interfere.
We're going to start. Invite. Well, it'll be interesting to see if that's the road it actually goes down.
Okay, I see. Chris Sullivan just, marched into the newsroom. Chris, do we have an update we want to hit you with?
Well, I'm doing a traffic here at 45.
At 45, okay, then we'll do a tease.
Latest step toward the creation of a robot army that will eventually overthrow and subsequently enslave humans is upon us. The people who created the Roomba now have an automatic lawnmower. What could go wrong? Self-propelled, whirring blades. We'll tell you how we're going to lose the fight with the robots next.
Welcome back to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tang here. John Curly away for just today. He'll be back tomorrow. We'd like you to text the Online Trading Academy text line at 98973. That's 98973, the Online Trading Academy text line. You know, in the last segment, I feel like we just sort of barely scratched the surface of the NFL and this possibility of an evaporating insurance market for it. And we realized that not only did we only scratch the surface, there's plenty more to say, but also we have Chris Sullivan. I know he's the cherry pie guy, he's the Viadoom guy, but he also has a lot of involvement in youth sports. He himself played high school football, played serious dorm football, I understand, at Notre Dame, which takes its football very seriously, full on tackle football for the dormies, no less. And he has a son who is considering a college career, would like to consider a college career in the game. So we thought we'd bring in Chris Sullivan as well. Danny O'Neill is filling in for John, and will join in on the discussion. But Chris, I was just wondering about how you saw the future of your child in terms of football and the dangers of CTE and the role the insurance market might play in his future.
Yeah, it's something, you know, obviously as a parent of someone who plays a competitive sport, whether it's, you know, football. I mean, Danny will tell you that the number one concussion sport is what, girls soccer.
We already talked about that.
I mean, it's obviously the health of your child is something that you take very seriously. There's nothing more personal or to anybody to that. And, you know, as a youth football coach, I could see where the insurance that, we used to carry as a league, things like that, if that were to dry up because they don't want young guys, I mean, it's like, okay, what do you do then? Mm-hmm. I could see the youth side, you were talking under high school, disappearing or greatly reduced there. But, you know, I'm of the opinion that if my son wants to play, and he does, and he's serious about it, I mean, it's my responsibility as a parent to cover him insurance-wise. And so I'm, you know, does it come to the point, I think what would be the breaking point is if personal insurance plans no longer let parents cover children who played those kinds of sports, because at least at this point, I believe it's my responsibility, not the school's, to cover my own child if they are injured. Now, if there's some malfeasance by the school, mm-hmm. Bad equipment, coaches that don't follow, the Lystead law, things like that, where there's some action, well, then, yeah, certainly. But it's my parental responsibility, just like I would provide him insurance for the car that he drives.
But there's some of this that it might not be your choice.
Yeah, that's the other point.
A school can decide that this insurance premium is prohibitively high. Mm-hmm. And tackle football, it probably has the highest equipment rate.
It is
the most expensive sport to play because of the equipment, because of the insurance, because of the staff that you need and the size of teams. It's significantly large. I think there's also something to be mentioned here, is that there is an ongoing dialogue about the impending death of football.
Yeah.
And there are people who are starting with the presumption that football will become extinct, and that the reporter you mentioned, Steve Finaru, and he and his brother at ESPN have written a number of stories about it, and they might not be wrong, and they might be similar to the reporters that covered the tobacco industry in pursuing and showing and exposing all of these different elements to it. But let's also be clear that they might be presuming an outcome here that we don't necessarily know is going to be true.
Right, and let's just hope, considering my son's age, they don't make this decision until he's done with college, which would give us 5 years, provided, of course, he doesn't redshirt. There's also, provided, of course, he goes on to play in college.
And a bigger hope, provided that he's healthy throughout that.
Without question. Okay. That's the number one.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that dialogue plays out. Staying home used to mean you were skipping work. Increasingly, it means you're doing work. We're going to explain what the past 2 weeks have taught us next.
Thanks, Chris.